All right, we'll make a start now, I think. Before we start, I should tell you who I am. I'm Kat Salmon, and I'm a researcher at LSE London, and I'll be chairing the session today. And I'm very happy to introduce Dr. Kavya Datta from Queen Mary, who's going to tell us about her recent research into migrants in the London economy. She'll talk for about 40 minutes, and then we'll take questions, and we'll attempt to finish by 6:30 on the dot. And as you probably noticed, this clock is wrong. It's actually 4:45, so we have about an hour and a quarter.
Thank you. And many thanks for the invitation to come and speak to you today about some collaborative research that I've been doing with colleagues for the past, I guess, 5 years now. And what I'd like to do in the presentation today is to focus on three key aspects of this research. And first, to examine the processes through which London's low-wage economy has come to rely upon migrant men and women. Secondly, to identify who these low-paid migrants are. And thirdly, to try and highlight the working conditions of these men and women. Now, just to begin by elaborating on the research project Global Cities at Work, on which this presentation is based, the project was funded by the Economic and Social Research Council, the ESRC, in the good old days when they were still funding research. The actual fieldwork period covered from 2005 to 2007. We finished most of the writing up in 2010, but we're still doing bits and pieces of it. As you'll see from the slide, it was a collaborative project which involved five other colleagues, all of whom were based at Queen Mary. Now, the broad aim of this project was to advance academic understandings of the importance of migrant labor in global cities, to try and produce comprehensive empirical evidence about the role and experiences of migrant workers in low-paid employment in London, and to highlight the implications for public policy. Now, while that was the primary focus of the research, you'll appreciate that once we started doing this work, we found that we could actually sort of cut the material that we were getting in lots of different ways. So for starting off from a sort of a focus on the labor market, we then also became very interested in how households were surviving. So we looked at household coping strategies and coping tactics, and how people who were working in very low-paid employment actually managed to live in a very expensive city. We then became very aware through our interviews with migrant workers that very often it wasn't just about their own personal survival or the survival of their families, but also about their obligations to their kin who they'd left behind in home countries. So we became more interested in sort of processes of uneven development and how this research could sort of speak towards the migration development kind of debates. We also did some work on global care chains through these migrant workers, and then looked at them as sort of gendered beings, as locating particular sort of ethnic and class positions. So it resulted in a very sort of diverse set of papers and findings. But given the primary focus of this research, we employed mixed methods framework, which generated over 400 questionnaire interviews, 103 in-depth interviews with migrant workers, which were then supplemented by 31 key informant interviews, which we conducted with employers, representatives of employer organizations, with migrant organizations, with policymakers in various arms of government. The migrant workers themselves, we drew from five sectors of the economy which we knew to be migrant dependent before we'd actually started the research. So these were in cleaning, where we looked at people who were both working as cleaners, cleaning offices, but also working on the London Underground, in hospitality, and particularly within hotels and catering, in domiciliary care, in construction, and in food processing. And this sort of primary empirical material was then supplemented by the development of new data sets through the help of people here at LSE, which was based on the labor force survey and analysis of wages taken from the annual survey on hours and earnings. And I'll be sort of, when I come to that point in the presentation, I'll be referring to all of these diverse data sets. Now, in terms of where sort of the project actually started, The changing dynamics of the labor markets of global cities have been the focus of much academic debate over a period of time. And they've largely been developed within the context of cities in the US, most obviously within the context of cities such as New York and Los Angeles, where key theorists such as Saskia Sassen argued as far back as 1991 that the labor market of these global cities reflected a growth in not only the top end of the labor market, which she attributed to a rapid expansion in financial and associated services, but also an increase in service sector job opportunities, which were located at the opposite end of the spectrum in the low-wage economy. And in turn, Saskia Sassen argued that the significant number of what came to be referred to as bottom-end jobs were filled by migrants. Now, while she was making these arguments and what she was saying reflected, broadly reflected what was happening in US cities, it appeared that another global city, London in particular, was an exception to these trends. And here it was posited by academics such as Chris Hamnett that even while the city had witnessed a phenomenal growth in its top-end managerial and professional jobs, this had been paralleled by rising levels of unemployment and economic inactivity, rather than an increase in the size of the low-paid workforce. And he explained these trends by drawing attention to two sort of key issues. The first was that the UK, in comparison to the US, had more generous welfare provision. And secondly, the UK, in comparison to the US, had lower rates of immigration. And for these reasons, then, he argued that what we these factors had inhibited the growth of both a working poor population, but also a foreign-born workforce. Now, when we started to do this research, it quickly became apparent that while these arguments had held some weight about a decade ago, London's contemporary labor market exhibited professionalism, it exhibited economic inactivity, but it also exhibited the growth of this working poor category. And as we've argued in the book that we've subsequently written, in more recent times, we could say that London's labor market has come to be characterized by polarization, whereby there's been a significant increase in the proportion of highly skilled workers employed at the apex of the city's labor market, which has been accompanied by a smaller but still significant rise in the proportion of workers laboring at the very bottom end. Now, perhaps even more significant is that this newly expanded low-wage economy is dominated by migrant workers, leading to the emergence of what we have then termed as a migrant division of labor. Now, as an illustration of this, in 2001, it was estimated that 46% of London's low-wage jobs were occupied by foreign-born workers. And indeed, this reliance upon migrant workers is even more significant, or was even more significant in certain sectors of the city, of the city's economy, as is evidenced in this table. So if you just look at, for example, the first occupation of chefs and cooks, if in 1993 and 94, 51% of these jobs were performed by foreign-born workers, by 2005, they were 76% of them were performed by foreign-born workers. And then further down in the table, and perhaps more significant, is in the cleaning sector, where 41% of jobs were performed by foreign workers in 93-94 to just under 70% in 2004 and 2005. So as such, it becomes clear that some parts of London's low-wage economy could in fact no longer function without the labour of migrants. Now, what factors actually account for the emergence of this migrant division of labour in London? And in our research, we attributed this to three key processes. The first was labour market deregulation, the second was welfare reform, and the third was the growth in transnational mobility. And if I take each of these in turn briefly, the British economy has undoubtedly been transformed in the last three decades as it has shifted from being dominated by heavy industry to being service-based. And this has been accompanied by a concomitant transformation of jobs for life to part-time working, part-time and flexible working, as well as escalating polarization between workers along a whole sort of host of cleavages. So there is polarization between male and female workers, polarization between skilled and unskilled, old and young, white and black and minority ethnic workers. Furthermore, the aggressive pursuit of subcontracting, with an estimated 93% of private sector workplaces now outsourcing at least one of their activities, has generally meant that wages have been held down, conditions of work have deteriorated, and the bargaining power of workers who can no longer easily identify their employers has also been eroded. Now, working in tandem with this, so these jobs which have been sort of labeled very correctly by a whole host of researchers as being dirty, dangerous, and degrading, working along the kind of this creation of these jobs has been welfare reform. And the attempts by the new Labour government in particular to shepherd the long-term British-born unemployed into these kinds of occupations. Now, new Labour, as I hinted at, sought to do this by pursuing a twin agenda of instilling a work ethic amongst its citizenry, which was a crucial foundation of its moral economy, as well as reforming the benefit system. And the reformation of the benefit system led to both a reduction in the real value of benefits as well as the number of people who were eligible for benefits, partly through the introduction of very complicated means-tested benefit procedures. Now, having said that that these kinds of reforms were aimed at trying to shepherd a long-term UK-born unemployed population into these low-paid jobs, such initiatives proved to be remarkably ineffective in actually achieving this. And this was evident in the fact that that employers were reporting shortages at the bottom end of the labour market. So where were the workers going to come from? Now, against this backdrop, the export of neoliberal policies to poorer parts of the world has delivered a workforce that is willing to fill these vacancies. The outsourcing of lower value jobs to locations with an abundant supply of cheap labour was a defining feature of the neoliberal reconstruction of economies in the global south in the aftermath of the so-called lost decade of development in the 1980s. And the development literature, of course, particularly at this point in time, paid a great deal of attention to the adverse impacts of neoliberal restructuring of developing world countries through structural adjustment programs. Now, one of the key sort of impacts of this neoliberal restructuring was that it generated migration. And initially, of course, much of this migration was internal and regional through the establishment of export processing zones, which were created by foreign direct investment. It led to the movement of different types of migrants, different types of people within countries. So in some parts of Southeast Asia, it was mostly female migration. In other parts of Asia, it was different types of people participating in this migration. But like I said, while it was internal and regional to begin with, this migration then became more transnational and international over a period of time. And contradictorily, perhaps, some of this migration was certainly a result of the kind of the negative impacts of neoliberal sort of restructuring. But other was contradictorily because of development, that people moved because their aspirations had increased, because of the fact that they knew what the other half lived like, what life was like at the other side of the globe, and they could now afford to move. Now, following a slowdown in immigration then in the 1980s to the UK, this then begins to show itself through the 1990s when we start to see levels of immigration in the United Kingdom beginning to increase very markedly. And if you're in a recent report by the IPPR on New Labour, the 13 years that New Labour was in power, shows this very significant increase in the migrant population in that point during that period of time. London, of course, has been historically a very popular destination for migrants, and the sort of this trend has continued under the new migrations. It is estimated by Spence that of all the migrants who had arrived in this country by 2001, 42% of them had settled in London. In the last 20 years or so, the proportion of London's population born abroad has doubled. By 2006, Spence was saying that just under a third of the city's population and just over a third of its working age population was foreign born. So migrants are a very sort of visible, if you like, entity in the city, in London. Now, having said this, almost as soon as migration begins to increase, so there are a great deal of pressures exerted on the state to show that it is in control of this migration, that it can manage this migration in the interests of the British economy. And this results through the 1990s in a whole host of managed migration policies, which culminate in the development and in the adoption of a points-based system. Now, the points-based system really reflects three key immigration priorities. The first is that it enables the UK to cherry-pick highly skilled migrants from a global market, which is essential if it is to maintain, and perhaps more crucially in the current period, to regain its competitive edge in the global market for skills. The second was that just as
the government at the time was beginning to listen to business and who were basically making the case that economic migration was good for London, was good for the UK. They were being pressed by other sort of pressure points to actually clamp down on what was referred to as bogus asylum seekers and irregular migration. So you would allow economic migration to increase, but at the same time you would push down hard on asylum seekers and on irregular migration. And the third priority was the expansion of European migration over and above migration from the global south. Now, the latter in particular was facilitated, obviously, by the expansion of Europe. First in 2004, when the A8 countries, the Ascension 8 countries, joined the European Union, and then again in 2007, when Bulgaria and Romania joined the European Union as part of the A2 expansion of the Union. Now, it is estimated that in a short period of time, so between 2004 and 2008, the number of A8 Europeans in the UK labour force were reported at just under 500,000, which was equivalent to just about 22% of all foreign workers. Now, part of the logic of managed migration policies has been that European migrants will fill the vacancies that exist at the lower end of the labour market, thus leading to a reduced reliance upon migrants from poorer countries of the world. So within our sort of our immigration policy, we see a distinct preference for European migration over and above migration from the global south. And that's quite significant because it sort of, if you like, reverses a historic pattern in migration. So as a result, what we see is that over a period of time, migrants from poorer parts of the world have seen their entry into the UK increasingly restricted to fewer and fewer options, so that they can come as students, they can come as tourists, they may be able to come as asylum seekers, as part of family reunification. And in the recent few years, even all of these routes have been increasingly sort of restricted and reviewed, etc. So what we then see is that the points-based system creates a strong hierarchy of rights amongst migrant workers. You have a migrant labour force which is comprised of those who have the right to live and work in the United Kingdom, and these are predominantly migrants from the A8 countries. We have a migrant labour force whose access to the labour market is somewhat more limited, such as A2 migrants from Bulgaria and Romania, who do not have the same free access to the labour market as A8 migrants. And then you have those migrants who really have no access to the labour market, and that creates a great deal of competition within the migrant population as well. The other point which I forgot to mention, but which I should have done, in terms of sort of as a further explanatory factor of why migrant workers actually fill up low-paid jobs, is that their own access to welfare is severely curtailed. So even when the European Union was expanded and Britain was one of only three countries in Europe to grant these A8 migrants immediate access to its labour market, it did take precautionary measures to limit their access to the welfare state. So that, for example, all of them had to register on a workers' registration scheme as soon as they entered the country and had to work, show that they had worked for a year before they were then eligible for welfare. And the welfare rights of migrants from the Global South and from the A2 countries are even more restricted. So, having sort of detailed the emergence of this low-paid economy and the fact that migrant workers are sort of being channeled into the low-paid economy, I want to now turn my attention to sort of look at the working lives of low-paid migrant workers and start by a brief discussion of who these migrant workers are. Now, the first key point is that these are recent arrivals, so that within our study, one half had arrived in this country in or after 2001, and a further third, or just over a third, had migrated to the UK between 1991 and 2000. So this is what you would sort of, what is very often referred to in the literature as the new migration. The second point, which is also very well known, is what has come to be termed as the super diversity of these migrant flows, this diversification of diversity, if you like. London is often referred to as the world in one city, and this finding was substantiated in the Global Cities at Work research, which recorded some 63 different nationalities, with the majority of migrants coming from Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, and Eastern Europe. And just because I'm a geographer and we love our maps, this is to sort of show you that same information in the map. But it does, I think, reflect something again fairly significant or distinctive about new migration, which is that where once migration to the UK was dominated by nationals from the Commonwealth, the Indian subcontinent, the Caribbean, these flows are now diversified, so that we're getting migrants both from the enlarged European Union as well as from parts of the world
which do not necessarily have the same historical connections with either London or the United Kingdom, particularly, for example, Latin American migrants, which one of my colleagues who was on this project, Kathy McElwain, has then gone on to study in more detail. The third crucial point is that these diverse migrant workers find employment in different sectors of low-paid work. And what is crucial here is that a migrant division of labor interplays with a gender and a racial division of labor, so that we could see very clear patterns in terms of who was doing what work in which sectors. So just to sort of go through, these 3/4 of cleaners on the underground were black Africans, 1/4 of office cleaners were Latin Americans, over 1/4 of workers in hospitality were Eastern European, particularly if it was front desk jobs. Most workers in construction were Brazilian and Poles. If we cut this data in a different way in terms of gender and see how it interplays with this, women were predominantly employed in what we term the semi-private sphere, so they were more likely to be working in care and hospitality. Men were more employed in the semi-public spaces, particularly in construction, which was 100% obviously male-dominated. Now, having said that, what is quite sort of interesting within this context as well is that we did see some crossover in that men took on what is often referred to as feminized work. So that we did find some men working in cleaning, we did find some men working in care. Interestingly, again, this was mostly black African men. So there seems to be a curious kind of interplay of gender, race, ethnicity, nationality working in tandem. That same kind of crossover is not observed amongst the 8-10 migrants, in that the 8-10 male migrants are taking on what they see as women's work. And this, again, might be a reflection of a different sort of hierarchy of the rights between migrant workers, that some are more vulnerable than others and therefore have little option but to abandon the kind of gender norms and their gender ideologies when it comes to the labor market. Now, also part of the explanation of who's doing what kind of work is through the recruitment process, so that managers and supervisors very often reinforced this kind of clustering by recruiting within their own ethnic groups. And this was sort of played out in almost across all sectors and elaborated upon by the majority of workers. Like Carlos, who was a cleaner from Honduras, who reported that his Bolivian supervisor would only employ Latin Americans. Barbara, who was a care worker from St. Lucia, would report that her Ghanaian manager preferred to employ Ghanaians. So this kind of clustering is very often driven by employers, by supervisors, by recruiters. Okay, so let's move on then to look at low-paid work from the perspective of migrant workers. There were sort of 4 issues that were very clearly sort of points of concern for the people that we interviewed. And these sort of coalesced around low rates of pay, poor conditions of work, a lack of respect and dignity at work, and divided workplaces. Now, if I take these in terms of pay, what a finding that surprised us initially was that the majority of the migrants that we interviewed actually earned the national minimum wage, which itself increased during the time, the period of our research. I say surprised us because we thought that we would come across more exploitation and more sort of evidence of people earning below the national minimum wage. The explanation for this is most obviously in the fact that the sectors through which we approach these migrants, that these were public sector workers and therefore had signed up to the policies of enforcing the national minimum wage. In subsequent research that all of us have done, so for example, in the last 2 or 3 years, I've been working on migrants and their access to financial services in London and looking and working with different migrant communities, so with Somali, with Turkish, with Brazilian and Bulgarian migrant communities, we see much more evidence of the fact that the national minimum wage is not upheld, particularly in the Turkish community, which very often is finding employment within a Turkish ethnic enclave, so they're working for Turkish employers, are drawing welfare drawing benefits at the same time, and so their employers then sort of justify their low wages in relation to that. But I don't declare how many hours you work, and therefore you are able to claim welfare as well. So there is evidence that this is not something that it's not representative of the entire labour market. Now, having said that, the majority of people earn the national minimum wage. The majority of them also earn below the London living wage, and that was a significant finding in itself. Because, as the GLA, as it itself proclaimed, the London Living Wage is extremely important in terms of just guaranteeing a basic level of survival in London. The majority of people were unable to, were not offered the London Living Wage. It has to be said that part of our research was to try and strengthen the case for the London Living Wage. So the questionnaire survey was done with London citizens of Summer Academy to provide the evidence that there needed to be a push for the London Living Wage in specific sectors in which the government and the GLA could actually make a difference. So we did push for this, and within my own campus in our university, our cleaners were brought in-house and started to receive the London Living Wage as part of this sort of the campaigning through this project. But in terms of sort of average annual earnings, what this level of pay means is that the average annual earning for a migrant who's working 36 hours a week is just over £10,200 a year before deductions, which is less than half of the national average earnings and just a third of London's average annual salary as well. So it's a very stark sort of message there in terms of actual levels of pay. Now, I don't want to sort of give the impression that these poor levels of pay permeate across all sectors. There was obviously some differentiation. So the highest sort of pay, and when I say highest, these people were maybe earning near to the London Living Wage at this point, so it wasn't anything like, you know, what we might sort of associate with the word. But it was in the care sector. And that might be because there are some kind of sort of, if you like, there's some value added to that work in the sense that people are required to have NVQs and all, and some kind of exhibit some levels of skills. So in the care sector, and that was also the sector in which there were fewer migrant workers overall, if you remember back to table one, levels of pay were certainly higher than they were in other sectors, and it's particularly when you came down to hospitality, that's where you had the poorest levels of pay, and that is also not surprisingly then the sector which has experienced the greatest amount of outsourcing and agency work. Now, compounding this sort of poor pay was these poor conditions of work. What you could say here is that not only do people have very poor, very low salaries, but they also don't have a social wage. So a half had no annual pay rise, a third had never had a pay rise. They lost time off, they lost pay for taking time off. They didn't receive sick pay. Two-thirds received the statutory minimum paid annual leave. Over two-thirds had no access to a company pension scheme. Over half worked very unsociable hours, which included for many of them night shifts, etc. So if you like, it's not just it's this lack of social wage, which is also a problem. Now, having sort of spent some time talking about pay, what was very interesting was that people didn't just talk about their labour market experiences in terms of what they received at the end of the day, in terms of their wages. Many of them talked about their labour market experiences within the context of a lack of respect for what they did, for the jobs that they did, but also for them as people, and a lack of dignity sort of associated with these jobs. For some, like Pedro, this was articulated within the context of de-skilling, that this is not my real job, this is not who I am, but I've had to take on this job in my movement to London, and that has then meant that I am not valued. So he said that many people think that we immigrants are used to cleaning in our country, but there are many immigrants who were solicitors, accountants in different professions. We are not just worth nothing, we have some value. And this is something that was noted across our samples, so across all the nationalities again that comprised the sample, if you like, was this the evidence of de-skilling and deprofessionalization of doctors, of accountants, of architects working as cleaners, carers, so people who had been de-skilled and were being deprofessionalized. The second point is really pretty much, I mean, in the same vein, but it was articulated in an interview that we did with a representative of the Central Association of Nigerians in the UK, in which he also articulated similar ideas about a lack of respect for migrant workers. And in his case, he was saying that the migrants are portrayed as all these criminals, and yet we actually hold the keys to all of these buildings because we are the cleaners, we are the guards, we lock up and we close down. And we are so untrustworthy. If Africans went to strike, there'd be no security men, there'd be no trained nurses on the wards, there'd be no cleaners, there'd be no traffic wardens. All the jobs that nobody else wants to do. So it was really not just about sort of the fact that the jobs weren't valued, but also that they as people, as migrant workers, weren't valued. That was articulated by a number of people. The fourth sort of key finding in terms of the workplace was this issue of sort of divided workplace and the evidence of tension that existed not just between workers and supervisors, managers and clients, but between workers, migrant workers themselves. Now, within the context of these tensions between workers and supervisors, you found that in some instances there were workers who complained that their supervisors were sort of, if you like, not upholding all the rights that they should have as a worker. They were asked to work unreasonable hours. They were asked to work unreasonable amounts of shifts. That there was evidence of some verbal abuse, although there was a lot of evidence of verbal abuse, but some evidence also of physical abuse from supervisors. But much more evident was this competition between migrant workers, very often within along sort of ethnic and national lines, and sometimes linked to racism. And as we sort of progressed through the research, it became apparent that a particular sort of cleavage was this distinction between being a European migrant and a migrant from a poorer part of the world. And so much of that sort of debate was about, well, these Eastern Europeans are coming and they are basically undercutting us, or the Eastern Europeans saying that we are, you know, we are better workers. And just to sort of illustrate this, Adesola, who's from Nigeria, said that she was working as a cleaner on the London Underground. She said that now they've introduced people from Romania and Bulgaria and they've brought them in. And what they do is when they bring them in, they remove some of these Africans. They tell them that these people are Europeans and they have a better right to work than you. Because these people, when they come in, they don't care how much you pay them. And there, a lot of the African migrants that we interviewed did sort of verbalize this feeling that they were being undercut by aid to migrants, which was quite an interesting finding. From the other end of the spectrum, then Mirek, who was a Polish construction worker, articulated that black people, who I consider see us as a threat, we are white, we are usually better educated. The English, who I think are not officially racist, but are rather open, would prefer to employ Polish, who work harder than a black person. I'm coming here to work, and I can work legally as a citizen, as a member state of the European Union, while others often are here because of persecution or had to escape war. So this hierarchy of rights is very apparent to migrant workers themselves. Mirek positioning himself as a European migrant with legal rights, as opposed to all of these kind of bogus asylum seekers who are coming here and working irregularly. So it was a very sort of, very often a very heated debate. But again, not to sort of leave you with the impression that this is what everybody was saying. There were other instances where people said that, well, actually, when I come to work, I meet people from so many different nationalities that I learn a lot through the world of work. So it's not just about division and competition. And also what is quite interesting is that in each community that we work with, they stress the point about how hardworking they were as Brazilians, how hardworking we are as Ghanaians, how hardworking we are as Nigerians, always in sort of as a counterpoint to the other dominant nationalities found in their sector. So compared with these sort of lazy Nigerians, we Ghanaians are much better workers. So there was a great deal of sort of, you know, pushing the boundaries of your own national group. Now, having said all of this, these kinds of issues were sort of, you know, being articulated in terms of what was wrong with the workplace, it's important to sort of understand how people make sense of their working lives. That if they're conscious of the fact that they're earning very low wages, if they're conscious of the fact that they don't have a social wage, that they're working in divided workplaces, that there is a lot of competition, etc., what actually, how do they make sense of their lives? And they seem to do this by narrating three sort of broad stories. The first is that if they compared their earnings in London to what they would earn at home, it was very favorable. So if you earned in pounds, that meant that you earned so much in Brazilian reals or whatever local currency that you compared it for to. So Janet said that money-wise, you know, here is better. If you compare the pay scale here to back home, it is better paid here. And that is one of the, I suppose, the dismal things about uneven development is that a teacher in Ghana and a cleaner in London have sort of, or a cleaner in London has a better wage than a teacher in Ghana. So it is that sort of, you know, the purchasing power of the currency that becomes important. The second was that it was very often related to acquiring goods that were seen as necessary to leading a good life, to leading a sort of a modern life. Louis, who was a Brazilian cleaner, said to us that what I managed to achieve here in 1 year, I would achieve there in 5 or 6. It sped things up a lot. So in a sense, what many migrant workers tended to sort of portray, at least, was that this is a short-term episode in my life, that I have come here, I am making money,
I know that I'm not valued, I know that the work that I'm doing is not valued, but I'm making money, and that will then enable me to buy a house, purchase land, etc., back at home and return back with all the things that are necessary to sort of live the good life. For others, it was even more sort of abstract than that, and this was really about the advantages of living in a global city, and particularly living in what many migrants posited to us was the center of the world. And this was something that Vijay, who was a care worker from Mauritius, said, that you get a lot of experience in London. You know people from around the world. You have an idea of how the world is. Perhaps you don't realize that when you come from another country like Mauritius, a small island. But the fact that it is small gives you a narrow perspective on life. When you come to London, you see the world as it is, large, big, and while the difficulties are big, the prospects are also big. You get a new perspective on life. Now, this said, it's important to sort of bear in mind that even while they're sort of making sense of the position that they're in through these kinds of narratives, and they're presenting their situations as short-term episodes, given the nature of uneven development, given the nature of inequality across the globe, the reality might be different for a significant number who find themselves trapped in low-paid work for much longer periods of time than they had anticipated. So in conclusion then, this presentation has identified the emergence of a migrant division of labor in London, where workers originating in both the Global South and Eastern Europe work in low-paid economies. Now, this in itself is attributable to a complex interplay of global and local neoliberal economic restructuring, the associated increase in transnational migration, as well as changes to welfare provision in the UK. And yet, despite their significance in low-paid employment, the contributions of migrant men and women are often invisible and very often unacknowledged. And as our book and our project sort of sought to do through its exploration of migrant men and women's working lives, it's not only the poor wage levels or working conditions which matter, it's also the need to value the jobs that migrant workers do, so these low-paid jobs, as well as migrant workers themselves. And just to sort of point you to the right websites, the main project output, I guess, is the book that I've been referring to, Global Cities of Work, New Migrant Divisions of Labour, which was published last year by Pluto Press. But we've also published seven or eight journal articles, a host of book chapters and working papers from the same project, and they're all available on the project website at Queen Mary. And thank you very much.
Thank you for that. You took us through a huge amount of material very quickly, and I'm sure it raises lots of questions. One I'd like to start with is, how did you, what types of people did you choose to interview, and did you look at people who were working in informal, sort of hourly cleaner type jobs?
No, we, given our sort of focus on the labour market, and also the way in which the research sort of evolved, through a sort of a partnership with London Citizens to do the work around the London living wage, we decided to go to sort of access people through sectors rather than, we could have gone in through migrant communities, but we wanted to access them through sort of specific sectors of the economy, and that's why we chose what we saw as migrant-dependent sectors, so through construction, food processing, cleaning, care, hospitality. And then really within each of these sectors, it was to use contact that we had within these sectors, either with trade union representatives or with particular sort of workplaces, and then to recruit people from that. So the initial stage of the research, the questionnaire survey, was done, like I said, through London Citizens Summer Academy, in which they take basically graduate students and train them up to sort of become community organizers. And part of that is done through specific projects, and one of the projects was the Living Wage Project. And so we had, I think it was 11 research assistants working on the project, sort of doing the questionnaire. So in the London Underground, they were standing. We would get permission from the station supervisors, and they would stand on platforms and try and interview cleaners in between the shifts. Around the care workers, we hung around a lot outside care homes for them to sort of finish shifts. The same, I mean, the one place where we did have quite significant difficulties in trying to access workers was in food processing. And I suspect that it was because in that sector there is potentially, I think, a little bit more sort of employment use going on. And I do remember staking out a few sort of food processing factories in Wembley
and waiting for, and they were like the South Asian women to come out, and I could speak the language, and that was one of the reasons why I was there for sort of after a week, and I think I recruited only to sort of 10 people. So it was extremely difficult, and they were very suspicious, and initially we were standing outside the factory, and then we actually moved back a couple of blocks and waited for the end of, because they have buses to take them back to where they live, so we actually hung out where the buses were parked rather than near their workplace, but it was quite difficult there. So it was just making sort of through contacts and then getting initial interviews and then snowballing from those interviews. But it was also a data set that evolved over the 3 years. So the initial data set through the London citizens was about 300, and then we added on the construction sector, so we did interviews there, etc. So it evolved over a 3 year period.
Thank you.
Yes,
I've got two related questions. The first one is, did you look at the age of the migrants, and if so, what did that tell you? And secondly, you said a little bit about migrants' aspirations. It seems to me aspirations is a very large chunk of this issue. Where did the migrants see themselves in 5 or 10 years' time? Did they see themselves, was there a certain proportion sort of themselves as Londoners, or did they just want to make a lot of money and go back to America more?
We did look at sort of, we did collect information on age, in the sense that we asked people how old they were. We didn't make a lot about that, of that analysis, except that you could sort of cut the, when it came to, in one of the papers that we wrote, which was on masculinities at work, you could certainly make a distinction then between younger men and older men in terms of how they actually talked about migration and what their migratory aspirations were. So we interviewed, I think by chance or maybe because of our sampling the strategy, amongst in the Brazilian community, we interviewed a number of young Brazilian men. And then you could talk about, and they talked about migration in a very specific kind of sense of migration being tied in with this kind of almost like an initiation ceremony, initiation rite, sort of trying to put a distance between themselves and their fathers in particular, trying to prove that they were independent men of the world, etc. Versus older men who talked about migration very much in relation to their responsibilities to their immediate families, their responsibilities to their wider families, and that is why they had moved. So there was some sort of difference in terms of narratives of migration, and then also in terms of justifying where they found themselves working in London's economy. So a lot of the African men that we spoke to who were working, not a lot, but the few that who were working in care and cleaning, when we said to them, well, why do you do this kind of work, or what's brought you to care work or cleaning work, very often they justified it in terms of their obligations to their families and the fact that, fair enough, I'm doing a woman's job in London, but I've got a family to feed back home. And that, I suppose, sort of also answers your second question, is that the aspirations could be cut in many different ways. That for some people, the aspirations were very much about improving their own lives, improving their families' lives back at home. So migration was very much linked to coming to London, coming to the UK, working for a certain period of time, acquiring certain assets in the home country, whether this was land or house or setting up a small business, and then returning back. For amongst these, going back to these same sort of subgroup of Brazilian migrants, there were young men who basically came to experience London. They wanted to go to the clubs, they wanted to travel in Europe, and they had to work in low-paid employment just to fund that lifestyle. And that was very much short-term. And it was pretty much, I think, linked to the fact that these were middle-class migrants, and therefore they were returning back to a life of privilege. And they had very privileged lives in their home countries, which, and it was all the more remarkable that they were doing the kinds of jobs that they were doing. So the aspirations were very different. In terms of sort of their long-term, even though they often talked about home, when we asked them, where do you see yourself in 5 years, where do you see yourself in 10 years, do you see yourself as having left the UK, very few of them responded in the affirmative. They always said that in the long term, I will go back home. But when you sort of confine that to a specific time period, so you said, well, in 5 years, where do you see yourself? I still see myself in London working. So they, in the abstract, they talked about returning home, but in sort of prescribed times, they didn't.
There's a couple of questions about employment agencies, which you touched on at the beginning of the presentation. I mean, did you, sort of quantitatively, did you get any sense of how important they were in the five sectors that you looked at, as well as what percentage of jobs were placed in agencies? And then secondly, did you go and talk to any of the agency personnel themselves about how they were organising and sourcing different migrant communities and migrant workers?
I think I can't remember the exact specifics of it, because I have possibly the worst memory in the world. But I do remember that one of the sectors in which we seemed to come across a lot of agencies was the care sector. So in that way, there certainly was evidence that it was being organized through different agencies. In the other sectors, I can't really remember off the top of my head, to tell you the truth. I'd have to sort of go back and look at the book, read the book again, or look at the data again, not read the book. But it's certainly very, very important in the care sort of sector, in terms of organizing workers, in terms of also then leading to sort of divisions amongst workers. I mean, the other example was from the London Underground, where workers actually said that there was a difference between agency staff and permanent staff in the kinds of facilities that they were offered. So they had to eat, as cleaners on the London Underground, they had to eat their lunch on the platforms, whereas the permanent staff actually had spaces, offices, or whatever reserved for them to go and eat their lunches, and that the workforce itself maintained this separation between agency staff and permanent staff. And that was then also reflected in conditions, not only conditions of work, but also pay levels, etc. So there was they did realize that there was a distinction and that they were discriminated against as agency staff.
I just wondered if your research threw much light on what kind of social organisations these workers were engaged with. I'm guessing union membership would be quite low.
Yeah.
Are people participating in sort of churches and mosques or cultural groups?
Yeah.
You mentioned London Citizens.
Trade union membership was generally low. If you were to take them in terms of sort of national groups, then I think it was probably the highest amongst Latin American workers, trade union sort of, or at least an interest in, even if they weren't members, at least an interest in some kind of organization to defend their rights as workers. In terms of the social organizations, faith-based organizations were hugely important to almost all of the communities that we came across, but particularly Brazilians, Ghanaians, Nigerians, very often they talked about, so if you said to them, what do you do outside of work, it was I work and I go to church on a Sunday. Most of them could identify specific churches, specific congregations, the fact that you now had sermons in their own languages, etc. And it obviously provided a huge source of comfort to a great many people, both in terms of sort of giving them a place where they could socialize. So a lot of Ghanaians and Nigerians talked about the fact that when you went to church, you met people from your own village or your own town. You could talk in your native language and you felt completely relaxed. And for others, this was almost like the only place where you could socialize, because either they were working such long hours that they didn't have much of a social life outside of work, they didn't have time to socialize, or it was too expensive in London to socialize. So, for example, Polish workers very often said to us that, well, you can buy much cheaper booze in the supermarkets than you can in the pub, and that's why I don't go to the pub, I'd like to go to the pub. Or it was their English language skills and the fact that I can't speak English, and therefore, you know, I would like to have English friends, but I don't have sort of the, you know, I don't have the means to communicate with them. So because of that, there's all, a whole host of reasons. Their social lives are very sort of very limited. And in that context, then the church or faith assumed a great deal of importance. And I think it's part of this wider debate of how migrant communities are regenerating faith in London and in a range of other cities. London Citizens wasn't important in terms of our migrant communities, although of course because there are this alliance of faith-based organizations, they do then incorporate many different migrant communities. But none of the people that we spoke to actually knew about London Citizens. So, there was a question.
Hi, I'm Richard
Lee
from the Just Space Network in London. And for us, campaigning to address poverty and inequality is hugely important. So I'm interested in your team's perspective, really, on what needs to be done, on whether you've come up with specific policy mechanisms to some extent, at least, bridge the poverty gap. Being specific, you mentioned the London Living Wage. Could you say a bit more about that, in terms of have you got specific recommendations which would enable more uptake? In both public and private sector. Have you addressed things like commissioning processes? Have you gone into that kind of detail? But it's not just, as you said, it's not just about the wage once paid, it's around what you call the social wage issues. It's also around the ability to organise In many different forms, not just for official trade unions, though that's obviously good, but organising perhaps unofficially as well. And it seems to me that one also has to look at this at a number of different levels, and one of them is the university level. We're here at a university. Did you look at what universities can be doing, not only around getting them to ensure they're paying the London Living Wage, for example, but when we have all the debates at universities around inequality and poverty, how often does the issue of migrant labour actually get a real profile in that debate? We're not the only group that's kind of marginalised, but too often I hear debates in the universities where we're looking at this in very big idea terms, very theoretical terms. I'm really glad you're here today, but I'd like to see your team be given a much higher profile within the university sector for this important work. I'm wondering whether you've got any recommendations on that as well.
We did. I mean, one of our—I go back to sort of the collaboration that took place with this project was that we came from very different disciplines within geography. So we were Jane has done a lot of work on the labour market. Kathy and myself are development geographers. John May is what you would call a social geographer. So we brought to it, and then we had our two RAs who were one, I guess you would say, is a development geographer, and another one who was a historian, and sort of came from it sort of from the perspective of sort of historical research and tradition. And we were sort of, so we brought a lot of many different sort of academic ideas to the table. And just sort of, if I say that before I say what we did in terms of public policy, one of the interesting things that we were able to do, I think partly because of that collaboration, was that we were able to theorize what we were seeing in the global north from the perspective of the global south. And that was quite sort of important, I think, because the predominant way in which Western academics and Western sort of knowledge is structured is that it flows from the north to the south and not the other way. And so things that we were engaging with as development geographers, when you started looking at the situation in the global north, suddenly you weren't allowed to use the same concepts, or you weren't allowed to use the same kinds of languages. And so it became really important to us to say, I mean, so Kathy and I would be looking at something and say, well, actually, there's been loads of stuff written on this from the perspective of development geography, and why don't we look at this set of literature and stuff? And so I think that was interesting in itself, because we reversed this kind of our thinking on certain sort of phenomena that we were witnessing in London and in the global north through using London as a prism to that. So for example, we started thinking about coping strategies, which was very much part of the development literature, and thinking about how that could be applied to the global north. And these are the same kinds of situations, the same kind of income maximizing, household expenditure reducing kind of strategies that people are engaged in order to make sense, in order to survive. And it was interesting to see how people were taking strategies that they developed in one part of the world as a result of sort of neoliberal restructuring and bringing it to another part of the world and then redeveloping them in this different context. So academically, I think we were able to do something that was of worth. In terms of public policy, it was very much our sort of ambition at the start of the research to have an influence on public policy, to have an influence on sort of, you know, the debates that were beginning to sort of take place in the mid-2000s. And to that end, we did disseminate this research very extensively, I think far more than any academic work that I've done previously. You know, we made presentations to the GLA, we made presentations to the Treasury, we made presentations, I mean, across all kinds of migrant organizations, community organizations, to basically just sort of say, you know, these are sort of the key findings of our research. And we were even up in Westminster making presentations. So certainly the research got heard and the research got picked up by people. In terms of what difference it made, I think we made sort of local differences. So yes, we made a difference for the cleaners at Queen Mary who were brought in-house and started to earn the London Living Wage. And for us, I think that was a very significant kind of achievement, because in many ways, sort of in academia, you do live in an ivory tower, so it's good to see sort of an immediate impact of your research in terms of organizing. We weren't able to go very far in terms of sort of furthering the agenda for organizing of workers, either through trade unions or other forms of organization, beyond just making sort of general recommendations that perhaps the way to organize people is through faith-based organizations, because those have such a central sort of meaning to their lives, that this might be a point at which they can actually be organized. The other sort of, towards the end of the project, the point that we were really trying to push was that we need to address as a society and as an economy, we need to address this sort of monster of low-paid work. And you need to improve the conditions of work. You need to invest in education. You need to invest in skills of both the UK-born population. And that we need to basically sort of, if you like, I don't know what the word is, but sort of put into these jobs or re-inject into these jobs a dignity, a respect for these kinds of jobs, pay decent wages for hard work. And if we improve these kinds of jobs, then not only do we address the problem of the long-term sort of native unemployed, if you like, but we also improve the conditions for migrant workers. So we don't necessarily have to see, you know, UK-born workers as being pitted. We mustn't see that. That's the whole point, that we need to get away from that kind of thinking of UK workers being pitted against migrant workers, which becomes a particularly sort of virulent narrative during times of recession. But to say that these are workers, and that what we need to do is to improve these conditions of work, which then addresses two different problems. So that was a kind of sort of message that we were trying to get across. The extent to which we did, I don't know. I mean, I think the Global Cities at Work was fairly well disseminated. It is fairly well known outside of academia. I don't know that it made a fundamental impact in terms of people's lives. Tony?
I mean, I want to pick up this kind of point further. I mean, there's other research that shows that, however much we may not like it, the low-paid migrant worker has driven down wages in part of the labour market. And there is a perception which has moved across politics that this group of workers is competing with indigenous workers, some of whom may be white British, but some of whom will be the sons and daughters of early migrants in part of the labour market. Now, I know your research is about what your research is about, but did you find anything in this research about what these people thought about those people, if I can rather tragically describe them as these people and those people, or indeed about the condition of the group that we're not talking about, which is the often out of work and long-term workless indigenous population, which it finds difficult for all sorts of reasons to take even these jobs. And if you take the care sector, I've certainly heard care sector, public sector professionals say they couldn't fulfil the functions of the care sector without migrant workers. Now that means that they are, in a sense, and that tells you about 20 different things at once. Anyway, did the research tell you anything about the invisible group of indigenous workers who weren't getting these jobs?
In very sort of brief glimpses, in terms of sort of how second generation migrants were sort of responding to these new migrants, or how UK-born unemployed were responding to these populations. It was only in the first stage of the questionnaire survey that we actually included UK-born workers as well. And then, fairly early on, given the ambition of this project, we made a decision that we had to focus it on migrants and new migrants, that is who we were interested in. Now that said, I mean, we did one of the, although it was sort of cross-sectorial, part of the research we got access through a bank in Canary Wharf, who gave us access to their cleaning workforce, and they were very interested in improving the conditions of work for their workers, and said that yes, we would like you to come in and do a questionnaire and do in-depth interviews, etc. So we did a week of went for the night shift to this building in Canary Wharf and basically interviewed workers there, and that is when we came across some British-born workers, and we did interview. And it was one of the few times in my life that I've actually, being a development geographer, I've actually interviewed a white person within that sort of a context, and we had a very interesting discussion. I mean, which was basically around the fact that he was employed in a workforce. He had been through very many different sorts of work, and he had basically been pushed along and made redundant, and then moved on to another sector and another sector, and had arrived in this bank in Canary Wharf, which had this remarkably global kind of workforce. You know, you had workers from all over the world. And we had a very interesting discussion in terms of, you know, and he started off the discussion by saying, "I am not racist, but..." At which point I was sort of like going, "Oh, okay, what is he going to say to me now, and how am I going to react," and all that kind of stuff. But in actual fact, what it was for him was really about the fact that he was working with people who very often he couldn't talk to because they didn't share the same language. That his work had been basically the center of his, you know, that had been the defining sort of characteristic of his life, because he still lived with his parents. He was in his 40s. He was, you know, he didn't have a partner or whatever. And so it was about going to work. It was about going to the pub after that, socializing with his workmates. And all of that had disappeared because of these people that he found himself working with, who had different cultures of work, who had different languages, etc. And so there was very little sort of interaction between them as workers. And there was this sense that, you know, they've come here and they're taking these jobs, you know, and sort of a conversation that was structured around it. But it was about a lot, you know, a much bigger picture than that. It wasn't just about sort of a crew, them and us. It was about changing cultures of work, changing cultures of masculinity, and all kinds of things that we spoke about. But the focus of this work was really on that. I mean, the ambition at some point was to try and sort of marry this to what is, you know, how do we relate this to a second generation migrant population or a white long-term unemployed migrant population. But all of us have sort of gone on to do different projects, and I guess when those end, maybe, and if it's still timely, we'll come back to issues like that. But they're very, I mean, and that is something that does come up a lot when we talk about this research.
Can I ask you two questions, which I suppose are about coping strategies?
Yeah.
One is, can you say anything at all about how these groups inserted themselves into the housing system? The other is, did any of them receive any benefits? Because, I mean, when we think about low pay, we often think about low pay being in a sense subsidized by tax credits, housing benefits, other benefits, which makes it possible to cope, to survive on these appallingly low rates of pay if you get these benefits.
If you get them.
But I guess most of the people you talk to don't get them.
Yeah.
It would be really helpful to know.
In terms of the housing system, we did ask them what where they lived and what kind of tenure. And for the majority of them, and it differed across different nationalities to some extent, it was they were finding housing in the private rental market. What was interesting was that in some of the communities, particularly in the Brazilian, and this has been borne out in subsequent research that I've done, is that you're now getting, if you like, ethnic landlords who are catering for specific sectors of the migrant community. So they talk about Brazilian landlords and that they rent from Brazilian landlords. And they describe the kinds of living conditions which are very well known now. Lots of people sharing the same space, and in many cases you're not renting a room, you're renting a bed. So fairly sort of overcrowded living conditions. And often sort of, if depending on how long they've been in London, you can see a kind of a progression in their housing, that they start off in accommodation like this, but might then be, by the time if they're, you know, sort of 3 or 4 years down the line, they might then be renting, still sharing a house, but renting with fewer, sharing with fewer people, etc. But most of it was through the private rental market. If I sort of bring on the findings or add on to the findings of my more recent research, then certainly through, it depends on how you came into this country in terms of what kind of housing you can access and when you came into this country. So if you look at the Somali community in London, and if you see those who came in the 1990s, they're likely to be in council housing. If you look at the ones who come in with the 2000s, who are much more likely to have had their asylum applications rejected and therefore irregular migrants, they're much more likely to be sharing either with family or then in the same kind of private rental household. Bulgarian migrants are overwhelmingly find their accommodation through estate agents in the private rental market. Brazilians overwhelmingly through friends and social networks that lead them. So it's different kinds of mechanisms in different communities. But your immigration status certainly determines your access to housing. And the same is true of in terms of your access to welfare. We did presume at the start of this research that we would see more people taking up welfare. We did not. And in almost all of the communities, the migrants spoke at great length about the fact that they did not come from cultures which were welfare dependent, that they had not sort of, they were not familiar with that kind of life, that they wanted to work for a living, they weren't, and up to the extent to which those were actually shaped by a very virulent right-wing sort of media, which calls them, you know, these, you know, benefits scroungers and all that kind of stuff, whether that was kind of in reaction to those kinds of narratives to say, well, look at me, I'm not a benefits scrounger. It was, you know, but they were very, very forceful stories about the fact that we do not draw benefits. That is not what we're about. But again, if I add on the research that I've done subsequently, then you find that benefit dependency in the Somali community is fairly high, in the UK, benefit dependency amongst the Turkish community is fairly high. And again, these are people who have come through asylum and therefore are eligible to welfare. Most of the people that we interviewed were not eligible, and they were not, at least to the extent that we were able to verify, trying to sort of engineer this access through various means. So very, very low welfare dependency.
Yes?
Lots of different things to talk about here. But you didn't include the NHS in your study or not. That's quite interesting, because people tell me that the minimum wage in the NHS for clean is £9 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
If that is the case, I mean, you just verify that. Because even that must be the dream job that everyone wants to mind in the move to, because it's so much better paying than the other ones. You talked a little bit about housing. Your film that finished in 2007,
these questions, but the first one was about the NHS pay. I don't know that what it is. It might well be £9 an hour. I do know that within our study, there was very often the turnover in these sectors was extremely high, and people would move if they were going to earn 50p more in Star, working as a cleaner in Starbucks, that's where you move. So the turnover is extremely high and is driven by wages. And so if people perceive that wages are high in a different sector, they will then move to that sector in order to capitalize on that. This difference in wages also exists between the agency and the permanent staff. So the sort of the short-term staff that are brought in are often paid low wages than the permanent staff. So there is an ambition also to sort of migrate from being from being agency to being permanent member of staff. In terms of the impact of the recession on migration, the research that I've been doing more recently coincided, which is I think sort of lots of events coming together at the same time, was looking at migrant access and use of financial services. And it was, the research was actually being done in 2008 and 2009 and 2010, during the time of the crisis. In terms of its impact on migrant workers, I did some research, or I did a paper where I looked at it specifically within the context of Bulgarian migrants, and looked at essentially the people who had decided to weather it out to stay rather than return, so what was happening to their labour market position. And the evidence seemed to suggest that they are in a more vulnerable situation than British-born workers. Not just in the UK, but sort of globally, where governments and employers made the decision that if anybody was to be fired, fire migrant workers first, stop hiring from overseas, etc. So there was a certain sort of, globally, there was this concern that the recession would be bad for migrant workers, that they would lose their jobs. Many of the Bulgarian migrants that I spoke to were construction workers, and they talked about a further erosion in their wage level, so that they're earning less for the same kinds of jobs. They're having to work longer hours to earn the same amount of money. So, migrants are telling us telling me in this instance that, once I was paid for 10 hours and that included my breaks, now I'm paid for 10 hours and it doesn't include my breaks, etc. So there was an erosion in pay levels. There was now A2 migrants, Bulgarian migrants are interesting because they're different from A8 migrants, because the restrictions on their employment were what's the word for it? They were
restrictions.
they were re-implemented. So it was supposed, when they joined when Bulgaria and Romania joined in the EU in 2007, the restrictions on their employment were supposed to be lifted 2 years afterwards, which coincided with the time of the recession. So at that point, the Migration Advisory Committee decided that we've got to extend these restrictions for a further 3 years because we don't know what the impact of lifting them might be. We might get, you know, a whole wave of Bulgarian and Romanian migrants looking for work in the UK, particularly because these are some of the poorest economies in Europe. So they extended those restrictions. So they don't have the same labour market mobility as A8 migrants. And that then means that because of the recession that they've had to really, and many of them articulated this, that we have to put up with whatever our bosses are telling us. Because the jobs are not out there, we find it more difficult to move between jobs, etc. So you have to accept this kind of erosion in both your wage levels, but also in your working conditions. And then they talked about it within the context of, you know, it having an impact on their mental health, on their relationships with their partners, which were breaking out, because the Bulgarian community is quite sort of a patriarchal community in the sense that a lot of the men said that it is the men who are losing jobs, there's all these cleaning jobs for women, but you know, we can't find any jobs. So again, it was interesting that they were crossing over to do these kind of women's jobs. But equally then that meant that their relationships were at breaking point because they didn't want to be maintained by their girlfriends or their partners. So but having said all of that, they, you know, when you said to them, would you return back to Bulgaria? Again, the messages that they were getting from family back home was, don't come back, it's much worse here. So it's much better for you to stay where you are rather than come back and be unemployed here. So really it was just to grit their teeth and sort of work their way through the recession. I'm sure I missed out on
the question. You're waiting the
moment,
what percentage?
We did ask questions about migration status, and not surprisingly, we got some data on it, but we didn't know how reliable it was. And so at a very early stage, we sort of decided that we can't really report on this. Partly because we asked people, what is your status? And we heard status that we didn't recognize, you know, I mean, like all kinds of things. I mean, you were thinking, well, what is, you know, what, that doesn't really exist, what does that mean? And some people, in a sense, I don't know that they didn't know what their status was, but they were quite sort of vague in terms of describing it. The only community in which, and I have to say this, having worked with this community now for the last 6 or 7 years in different projects, is the Brazilian community, which is remarkably honest in terms of their immigration status. So it's almost like in the first half hour of your conversation, they will tell you I'm irregular. You know, I came as a student, that expired 6 months ago, and since then I've been working irregularly. Or I came as a tourist, I was supposed to go back home, I never went back home, and I've been working irregularly. So you get very sort of very honest stories about irregularity, and I would say interesting, that's all a bit like sort of paternalistic kind of thing to say, but you know, very nuanced stories about what being irregular means, you know, about being scared of the police, and therefore people, for example, in the Brazilian community often said to us that I never take the tube to work, I take the bus to work. And we thought, well, is that because it's cheaper to go by bus than the tube? And it's because Transport for London have more police on the tubes, and you might get picked up at a tube station or whatever. And especially in the Brazilian community, the killing of
John Charles
Menezes had a huge impact in the community. So they wanted to, you know, travel by bus so as to avoid the police. And you know, all kinds of strategies that if you're working in the construction sector, don't carry your tools around with you too, obviously, because if you get stopped by the immigration, they look at your tools and realize that you're a worker and not a student because, you know, you've got a spanner instead of a book in your bag and that kind of stuff. So different strategies and how really, and this was something we developed in the masculinities paper, which was how people felt sort of emasculated by their irregular status, not just in their economic life, but also in terms of just as social beings. What being irregular does to your state of mind, the kinds of, you know, the ways in which irregularity structures what you do, when you do it, where you do it, who you do it with. So there are very far-reaching implications in terms of people's lives, and very damaging implications, I think, particularly given the current context where it's becoming, the noose is getting a lot tighter.
I think we have time for two final questions. I have one here, and then Christine.
I'm a little bit bullied because again, it's very interesting what you're saying, and it's very complex and very diverse and so forth. But I would like to bring up this issue about multiculturalism, which is now very much discussed, because we have said 69 nations and so forth, and London obviously is very multicultural instead of bloody cultural, more multicultural.
Yeah.
And we're also saying that the strategies that people have to live a life, not just work, but a social life, you say they face communities and so forth, which for me are isolationist in a certain way. Okay, they fail to find solace within themselves, but they will, it's a sort of reverse ghetto movement, if you like. And henceforth, now with the harder times, I mean, research was 2007, but now the harder times that you can hear, you know, in the Mail and the Sun and stuff like that, have all sorts of different hardened attitudes.
Mm.
It's perception, it's nothing to do with this, this is the reality of the white unemployed male community in the New England, so forth and so on. And henceforth, as I wondered about the longer term perception, because you say, okay, the ones who say, I come here, I make money, I go back, I have and so forth, and then it doesn't happen. So we have these kind of aspirations, and then the change over time. I mean, I know people have been living 30 years, and they're still saying, I'm going home soon. You know, I mean, these things are also reality, but which means that they're isolating themselves in their own cultural communities, and henceforth they don't learn the language again. So how can it create any kind of interaction? And that is like what I feel, all those aspects about the respect and the dignity and all that, doesn't have also that to do, that you track them from all that, you do not.
The only way I would sort of counter that is that through the research, many of the people that we spoke to said that, you know, I mean, for example, in the going back to the Brazilian community, that one of the ambitions was to come to the UK to learn English or to speak better English, to speak English with a British accent. That was very important to many of them, and that it would have important implications in terms of their career mobility back home. What they said was, and I remember talking to one young man who said to me that, you know, my father thinks that I speak perfect English and he doesn't know that I live in a sea of Brazilians here. I have no English friends. Now the problem with that is it's not something that is voluntary, in a sense that you choose not to have English friends. It is the places where people work that they don't necessarily have any English work colleagues, so they're working in sectors which are dominated by migrants, either from their own nationality or other nationalities. That they work such long hours, so many of them, I mean, I didn't go through the coping strategies, they're not just doing one job, they're doing two jobs, and in some cases even three jobs. So one guy I remember talking to was, the only place where he said he slept was on the bus, in between his jobs, when he took the bus to travel to his different jobs. So they're working very long hours. And third is that they do not know the language, and language is a hugely important issue, obviously, in determining the level of interaction that takes place between migrant communities and the host population. And that's why, I guess, in a sense, if you're thinking about public policy intervention, it was there, but it sort of disappeared, particularly in the recession, is investing in language training for migrants, because not only does it lead to their social integration, but, you know, within the context of my more recent work, it has direct implications in terms of their financial integration, their ability to open a bank account or to acquire formal credit, and all of that depends on their English language skills. But I would sort of, you know, reiterate the point that many of them said that, you know, my ambition was to come and learn English culture, learn the English language, have the English friends, you know, make sort of integrate in this community. But it is the situation in which they find themselves that makes it very difficult for them to integrate themselves. So I wouldn't say that this is a voluntary kind of shutting themselves off and saying we don't want to be part of that society. It is that we cannot be part of that society. We don't have, and language is a major stumbling block. That is what we need in
lesson. Sounds horrified, you like some of the stories one gets from students here, of being isolated into their own groups. And that sounds like really the question I was going to ask was about whether being in the group, particularly in terms of landlordism and these types of issues, is this a help or a hindrance?
Well, some people talked about it in positive ways, that the community, sort of the migrant community, was what gave sort of solace, and what, particularly in the Ghanaian and Nigerian community, within the context of a faith community, which was very much along national lines. Others did speak about competition within the community and rivalry within the community. And again, you could sort of take this across different nationalities, but they, you know, some, what we often say, when, you know, and I've made the same sort of, I've done the same thing that I've talked about the Brazilian community, the Somali community, these are very heterogeneous communities. A lot of the men that we, young men that we spoke to from Brazil, for example, made much about the fact that some of the Brazilians that we meet in London, we've never met in Brazil. We would never, we socialize, not socialize, we wouldn't be working in the same places as these people, because